I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Even if you don't know his name, which you probably do, you likely know the work of John Grisham. He's the author of more than 30 novels, a dozen of which have been adapted for film, including The Client and A Time to Kill. Even Christmas with the Cranks was based on a Grisham book. Today we sit down with a prolific writer who's also a former attorney and Mississippi state lawmaker. Among other things, we'll ask him about his latest novel, which reveals a scam behind many for-profit law schools. Don't let the dry description fool you. It also includes the high drama, conspiracy theories, and verve his readers know and love. We'll get you up to date with John Grisham after this hour's news. Here's a guest that needs no introduction, John Grisham. Here's something you probably didn't know. He's now the author of 31 novels, including his latest, The Rooster Bar. Most of us will recognize any number of his runaway bestsellers, The Firm, A Time to Kill, The Pelican Brief, which just happened to be the first three books he wrote. John Grisham is in town. In fact, our own best-selling author, Candace Millard, will interview him tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. John Grisham was last on this show back in 2012, and welcome back. So nice to have you here, John.
It's always been always good being in Kansas City.
You know, let's go back to 1991. That year, you published The Firm, your first book that came out a few years earlier. That was followed quickly by The Pelican Brief and The Client. And then in about a year's time, three of your films hit, and you were the talk of the country. What was that time like for you? Because you were a small-town lawyer from Mississippi.
Well, looking back with the benefit of a quarter of a century in hindsight, it was pretty crazy, pretty hectic. Those three movies came out in the span of 12 months.
That must have been just a kick.
It was a riot. It was so much fun. We, you know, we wondered what had hit us, what was going to happen next, but it was a great deal of fun. Our kids were young. We were all enjoying it together. From the summer of 93 to the summer of 94, those three movies came out. They were all big movies with big casts, big box office grosses. You know, it was just a lot of fun. And the books were selling like crazy. A Time to Kill had been discovered and brought back, and it was at the top of the list, and those three books were at the top of the list. And so it was a pretty wild ride.
A Time to Kill came out, what, in 88?
June of 1989, and 89. It flopped. It didn't sell.
It didn't sell. You were trying to hand them out to friends, and suddenly you have all these books that are just clicking and selling, and the movies are hitting. How did you handle all that?
Well, when The Time to Kill came out, again, it didn't sell. They printed 5,000 hardback copies and never went back for more initially. When The Firm came out in March of 91, it found a market real fast. And so a lot of people who read The Firm realized there was an earlier book, and there was a lot of demand for that book, and there were no copies of it. And so it took a while to get the publisher to print some more books, and we sold a bunch of them. And by then, The Firm was selling very well, and Time to Kill was selling very well, and I was almost finished writing The Pelican Brief, and I took some very good advice and got The Pelican Brief out the year after The Firm and the year after. And I didn't know it was going to be 25 consecutive years, but that's what it's been.
Was it a lot of pressure getting those books out one after another? Because you've shown that doing a book a year is sort of what your pattern is, but also trying to produce early on might have been a little bit of pressure.
I don't recall pressure. It was so much fun. We were having so much fun, and the books were, very popular, and people were saying all nice things, and the movies were coming. I never felt the pressure. I have never felt the pressure after almost 30 years to produce a book this year or next year, it's just what I do. It takes about 6 months, a year to write a book, to write a legal thriller. And that's what I'm going to do from January to July of every year. And I've got the story for next year and probably the one after that. And, you know, that's what I That's what I do. I think of stories to write, all involving lawyers, judges, break-ins of gun stores, shootings. Where, you know, people think that's where I get my ideas.
So what happens from July to December?
Well, I turn the book in the first week in July. The goal is always July the 1st. It takes about 6 weeks to edit and kind of polish it up and get it ready to print. Usually by Labor Day, I'm bored and I start writing something else, kid's book, or I've written two football books, a baseball book. You know, I'll try something else. Nothing this fall. I was not inspired to write this fall. Last fall, I wrote a book called Camino Island, which came out back in June of this year. So two big books this year, and that's too many. Probably won't do that again. But, yeah, I mean, I'll get bored. I mean, I'm always writing something. A lot of the stuff I write in the off season doesn't quite make it, which is fine. I kind of purge it. That's what writers do. But I'm also thinking about the next legal thriller, outlining, planning, researching.
You mean John Grisham writes books that don't get published? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I've never written. No, I don't finish the books. I'll write. I may tinker with a screenplay.
Right.
I may tinker with a stage play. I may tinker with a short story, or a kid's book, or the next idea, or taking notes for an outline. Right now, I'm taking a lot of notes about the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. There's a big, thick legal thriller in there somewhere. Okay, I don't have the story yet, but there's so much going on. There's so many issues, so many balls in the air, as I like to say, between the manufacturers, big pharma, the doctors, the hospitals, the criminal justice system. There's a novel there somewhere. I haven't found it yet, but I'm on the trail. I'm taking a lot of research and notes. That's how I stay busy and stay out of trouble in the fall.
John Grisham is my guest. You know, John, a lot of would-be writers out there hearing you say that you take no more than 6 months to kick out a best-selling legal thriller, that's going to frustrate a lot of people. That's you can do it that fast.
Well, it's a process that I have honed after many years of writing from January through July, 5 days a week, 3 or 4 hours every morning, with few breaks. Although if we want to go somewhere, we go somewhere. Pretty disciplined about it, but also what drives it is the fact that I spend so much time before I start. One of my rules for writing popular fiction is never write the first scene until you know the last scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you always know where you're going, and when you write a book, it's hard to get lost. But I spend a lot of time chapter by chapter by chapter planning the novel. Mm-hmm. And then that takes a long time. That's not any fun.
Do you outline it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's outlined. It's when you outline the entire story from start to finish, you see the whole story, and you realize maybe what you don't need or maybe what you do need. You can't – there's no way you can predict what's going to happen in the course of a 500-page novel. And you don't want to predict everything because of the surprises are always fun.
Mm-hmm. The surprises in writing, things you hadn't thought about that come to your mind as you're putting
it
together.
Oh, yeah, or a character will take over. A character will really become important, or a character you thought you were going to need, you get to kill off. It's always fun to kill them off. But yeah, you just never know in the course of a 6 month period when you're writing every day what exactly is going to happen. But when you have the basic plot from the beginning to the end, it's hard to get lost, and it makes the writing so much easier.
Hey, have you ever gotten halfway through and thought, we're not there, it's not working?
I have never done that. I know a lot of writers, a lot of friends of mine, who will have a great idea for a novel and she can't wait to get started and write 100 pages or 200 pages, you know, because with all this creative enthusiasm, you know, and then realize they're not sure where they're going or how to end it. And it becomes frightening. It becomes frustrating. And a lot of times they have to abandon it. Well, they've wasted a year or two. Mm-hmm. I'm too lazy to waste a year or two. I'm just not going to do that. Yeah. I'm very methodical about it. But again, if you want, when you write suspense, you like it's like writing a mystery. You have to drop off certain clues along the way, and you better know where you're going.
John Grisham is here. He'll be in conversation with our own best-selling author, Candace Millard, tonight at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information, just go to rainydaybooks.com, and you'll find out more information there. You know, you said early on, John, that A Time to Kill comes out in 1989, and it didn't sell. The firm hits a few years later, and it goes crazy. A Time to Kill was a good book. So why didn't that one hit, and the firm went wild?
It's hard to explain. When A Time to Kill was published, it was published by a small, new, unknown imprint in New York. In fact, the company went bankrupt the following year. It had one or two novels, and it just I didn't have any support. They didn't have any money to promote it, and so I called bookstores and went to bookstores with a trunk load of books, and I did it myself. I went to
happens here all the time. I see it every week.
I went to 35 libraries around the state of Mississippi to have library parties with, you know, friends of the libraries, punching cookies, and I'd sell three or four books. So, you know, I was trying to make something happen. So there was no national marketing campaign, and that's not unusual for first novels,
right?
And I did not know. I mean, I love the story. I love the book. I love the characters. It was very autobiographical. I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't foresee that it would one day outsell all the others.
Yeah. Has it really?
Yeah. If you look at the, 25 years later, A Time to Kill, Firm, Pelican. Those books have all sold a lot, but A Time to Kill's sold the most.
I'm surprised that it's not the firm.
Yeah. You know what? One other factor, a huge factor, is the movies. The movies of those first few books were fun films to watch, and they are probably somewhere on cable tonight.
Right.
And they still sell a lot of books.
What was that like for you watching your literary work show up on the big screen? Because, again, different authors come in here with very different experiences about what that process was like. And here you are, were you hanging out with Tom Cruise and hopping bars in Hollywood with him? Was it that kind of experience?
I've never done that. We normally go to the set once or twice and meet everybody. And there's nothing more boring than watching a movie being filmed. It's just, it's tedious work. I think I met everybody who was in the movies way back then, but you don't establish friendships.
Right.
It's a weird business. It was terribly exciting. I've had 9 of the books adapted to film, and 8 of them were enjoyable. The Chamber was a bad movie from the very beginning, from the screenplay to the end of it, and
wow.
I told them so, and nobody went to see it, and I was kind of happy nobody went to see it. But it was no fun to watch. But
right.
the others were all fun to watch.
John Grisham's here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. I should point out that the Rainy Day Books event tonight is sold out with John Grisham. Maybe not a big surprise. Maybe they'll put it online. They'll put something up on their website later on today. But if you want to ask a question of John now, 816-235-2888. You know, you were a lawyer early on, and then you made your way into writing these novels, John. Did you have a sense... was there something instinctive deep inside you that you sort of knew that, A, you wanted to be a writer, and, B, you knew how to put together a legal thriller?
No.
But you wanted to do it, though, right?
Well, no, not as a child, not as a student, not as I was 30 years old before I wrote anything except legal briefs and stuff like that that nobody wanted to read anyway. I don't know. I knew I was never afraid to write papers and things. I always knew I could handle the language, and I was inspired by a real courtroom drama that I witnessed, and I fell in love with this story about a big trial in a small southern town, as seen through the eyes of this idealistic young lawyer. And I was very much like that myself, a guy who was struggling, dreaming of the big day in court, the big verdict,
yeah.
the big victory. That was me.
Mm-hmm.
Dreaming of being a, big-time trial lawyer. The lawyer you call when you were in trouble.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to be. And I was in the courtroom a lot. That was my dream. And I don't know. It's a talent that I didn't know was there. It's a God-given ability to be able to write stories that people enjoy reading.
When you wrote A Time to Kill and you wrote The Firm, did you think they were good books? Did you have a sense as the guy putting them together? Because sometimes, as a lifelong journalist, you write a story and you think it's really good, and it's not. You know, sometimes you just can't even gauge your own work.
With A Time to Kill, I had no idea what I was doing. I just had no idea. Now, I've always been a big reader. Most writers are. And I was reading everything I could find on the bestseller list. Okay, that was my focus. And I would read a bad book that was selling well nationally, and I would say to myself, I can beat that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I would read a good book, and I would say, I'm never going to be that good. However, there's somewhere on the list for me. I think I can fit somewhere. I can write better than these folks, not as good as, you know, I was fairly honest with myself. My wife was a big factor because she encouraged me to write chapter 2 of A Time to Kill after she read chapter 1. And so I said, all right. And
hadn't you put it aside?
Do what?
Hadn't you put it aside, or what story am I recalling?
I put it down a few times.
Yeah. And she said, I think you got something here, John.
Yeah, I put it down, and she would, she always knew when I wasn't writing, and she would eventually say, what's going on? And I would say, okay, I'll get back to it. It was frustrating. Again, I didn't really know what I was doing. But I love the story. I wasn't sure how to tell it. The original draft was close to 900 pages long, which is far too much. When I finally found an editor, a really good editor, he cut out a third of it.
Wow.
That was a year of my life. It took me 3 years to write A Time to Kill, so cutting out a third was a year.
And did you argue with that, or were you okay with it?
Oh, I was fine with it because he was right. And he was a professional editor, and he knew how to fix it, and he did. And I vowed at that point I'm never going to waste time writing again because time is too valuable. I'm just not going to waste that kind of time. And I'm going to outline the next story carefully and know exactly where I'm going and what I'm doing. Now, when I wrote The Firm, and I started The Firm after I finished A Time to Kill, I loved the story from day one, and my wife was a big cheerleader. She loved the story of The Firm. I had talked about it for some time, and she kept saying, that's a big book if you can just get it done. And I sent a 2-page outline of The Firm to my agent in New York, and he had the same reaction.
Huh.
He said, this could really be big. Just get it done. And it took me 2 years, but I was really motivated. In the meantime, A Time to Kill came out and didn't do well, and so I was frustrated by that. But that's not unusual for a first novel. I knew that.
Right.
And so I was really excited about The Firm. And when I turned it in the fall of 1989, I was, you know, hopeful, confident, but still I had no idea what was coming.
Do you remember the moment that you learned it was taken off? A phone call from your agent saying, you aren't going to believe this, John, but this thing just hit.
Oh, well, yeah. the opposite happened. When I turned the book in, the agent wanted me to make some changes to the story that I wasn't going to make. We got crossways, and I said, I'm tired. There it is. And he showed it to a few editors in the fall of 89. There was no there was no stampede. Nobody wanted to buy The Firm. And late in the year, this used to happen all the time back before the internet, a bootleg copy of the manuscript popped up in Hollywood, and a guy got it out there, a producer or an agent or somebody. I don't know what he was. And he ran like 25 copies of it and sent it to all the studios. And claiming that he represented me, and he got nervous when they started making offers, and I knew nothing about this. Just, I was at home in Mississippi, you know, practicing law every day, and then the offers got serious and more serious, and at the last moment, somebody thought, well, hey, we better call Grisham and see what he thinks about it, and my agent from New York, you talk about the phone call. It was the first Sunday in January of 1990, and my agent calls and says, basically, he said, I need your authority to take the highest offer from Paramount, Universal, or Disney Touchstone for the film rights to The Firm.
And it hadn't been published yet.
There was no book deal. I hadn't heard a word in 2 months. And I said, what about the book deal? And he said, well, we'll talk about that later. We can't talk about it now because these studios are standing by their phones for the final round of bidding. And the word bidding had a nice ring to it. And I said, okay, whatever, go, you know, sell it. So we sold the film rights right then to Paramount. It was a big deal. And it was in the newspapers, and we couldn't keep it quiet. And then the publishers woke up, and the following week we sold the North American rights to Doubleday. And then the following week it was the British rights, and the following week it was the German rights. And we were in shock as the book kind of marched around the world, language by language, and that was 1990.
So this rogue Hollywood producer guy, you don't know who it was, in a sense, made your career.
Oh, it was the luckiest break I've ever had, anybody could have, and I had no idea what was happening. Oh, I know who the guy is. Yeah, we all kissed and made up.
I was going to say.
Yeah, we all bought him dinner. We all did well.
Yeah.
but there was no hard feelings once we had a deal.
John Grisham's in the studio here, 816-235-2888. Our phone number, Daryl from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. And how you doing, Steve Kresge, John Grisham? Good morning, sir. I'm Daryl Burton. And, John, you may not remember me. You've met a million people. But I'm friends with the one non-fiction book that you wrote by Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson. And I was exonerated also 25 years in prison wrongfully. And I remember meeting you several times. And my case was, you know, about complexion. And so I'm a dark-skinned man. And I remember you said, you know, Daryl, I don't know if you noticed, but you're not light-skinned. It was a light-skinned guy who committed the crime. And you said, you're not light-skinned. I'm light-skinned. And you're very dark-skinned. And of course, we kind of had a laugh out of that. But my question is, I know you probably don't think about doing a nonfiction again, but if you did, would you consider doing another nonfiction on a wrongful conviction? And if you also would think about doing something in comedy, because, man, you're very funny. I've met you at least three times, and you're a hilarious guy.
Well, thank you, Daryl. I'm not sure how comedy goes hand-in-hand with wrongful convictions, but you guys always manage to have some laughs, and we do when we get together.
Yeah.
You know, I've said several times I'll never do another nonfiction book, but and I have no plans to. But every time I read a story about a wrongful conviction, I want to write the story because they're all fascinating stories about what you guys went through. You spent 25 years for somebody else's crime.
Right.
And the injustice that you went through. I mean, wrongful convictions don't just happen. They are mistakes or a lot of times intentional wrongdoing by the authorities that lead to wrongful convictions. And it's fascinating to explore that behavior by police and prosecutors and judges and juries and how you actually reach a point to where you convict an innocent man. Those are fascinating stories. And I'm always tempted to write them, but I don't have one planned for right now.
Well, I got one for you because I've done my memoir.
Daryl, good luck to you, man. Good to hear from you.
Daryl, have you been here in the studio before?
Yeah. I don't think I've been in the studio before, but I'm sure I've been in the community for the last
right.
9 years since
right.
I've been home. And so I've talked to you guys. You and I think, Brian,
yes.
I've been in a lot of places, you know. So
well,
I can't say that I've been in the studio.
Daryl, it's good to hear from you. I sure appreciate the phone call.
Yes, thank you.
You bet. Good luck. Let's take a break, John. When we come back, let's talk about your work for the Innocence Project, something you've spent a lot of time and a lot of energy on. And we'll take your questions, too, for John Grisham at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Steve Kresge. You're listening to UpToDate on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can listen to Friday's program on KCUR.org and hear two Kansas City relief workers describe recovery efforts in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. We also talk with the authors of a new Missouri Almanac. That's at KCUR.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow on Up to Date, Kansas City, Missouri Councilwoman Jolie Justice discusses the airport ballot question. We'll take your questions, too. Kansas City voters decide that question November 7th. Also learn about the different perspectives that Vietnam vets had during the war, depending on when and where they served. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. This hour, a mega best-selling author, John Grisham, is my guest. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, I want to get to the new book, John, but I also wanted to ask you about your work for the Innocence Project based on Daryl's phone call right before the break, because I know how much time you've spent on that. We just had a case here involving a man named Lamont McIntyre who spent 23 years in jail for a murder he didn't commit in Wyandotte County, just 10 minutes from here. How did you get involved in the Innocence Project, and what are you still doing for them?
I got involved in 2004 when I started working on a book called The Innocent Man, which was not a great title, but then I struggle with titles, the firm, the client, the partner, I'm not very creative.
Well, I guess they work, John.
They work. Yeah. I mean, I wish I could have a To Kill a Mockingbird every year, but I just can't do it. You know, I just can't. No one can. Yeah. It was a story of a guy in Oklahoma who spent 11 years on death row and came within 5 days of being executed. And also a guy from Kansas City, Dennis Fritz, was his co-defendant. Hmm. And I researched that story for a long time and wrote the book that was published in 2006 and you know, found an audience. And by then I was really, I think, kind of surprised and shocked and dismayed and frustrated at the number of innocent people who are in prison. Mm-hmm. And once I realized, well, I never thought about it before, but once I got involved in the research and the book, and I was invited to join the board of the Innocence Project in New York, and I said, sure, I'd if I can help. And I've been here, I think, twice to do fundraisers for the Midwest Innocence Project. Great group.
You were on the show with the last time, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've done a fair amount of that traveling around the country. There are about 50 Innocence Projects around the country, all of them sort of independent. There's a network. They try to help each other out. They're all grossly underfunded. They don't get money from the government, so they have to rely on private money, and it's hard to raise money for wrongful conviction. So right. I'm always, like I told Daryl Burton, I'm always tempted to do it again because I love these stories.
You know, as you watch these dramas unfold around the country, all these examples of innocent people on death row or in prison for one thing or another, what needs to happen? What's wrong with our system that results in this? And where should we be going here?
One thing we do with the Innocence Project is push our legislative package in all 50 states. And we have some proposals that, if they were enacted, would virtually eliminate wrongful convictions.
Such as
false confessions. And when 25% of our case, we have 265 DNA exonerations now in the past 25 years. In 25% of those cases, they involve false confessions. These bogus confessions that the cops extract after brutal interrogation tactics that last for 15 hours.
Yeah,
and people say, I will never admit to something, a crime I didn't do. Well, you would too if you were subjected. You know what you would do. Just video the interrogation.
Yeah.
Because you just video, and even go beyond that. If you have a person you're going to charge with capital murder, get his lawyer involved. This is get the lawyer involved up front and protect his rights. Don't bang out some confession. A big problem is, and like 70% of our cases involve junk science, bad forensic evidence. Whether it's in Dennis Fritz's case, Ron Williamson's case, the guys I wrote about, it was hair analysis, which the FBI says we get wrong 95% of the time. That's the FBI. Bite mark analysis has convicted a lot of guys, a lot of people on death row now from bogus bite mark analysis. Footprint analysis, all this junk science that gets into our trials and still gets into our trials. We're not even sure about fingerprint analysis anymore. Bad defense lawyering, A lot of times the defense lawyer is a rookie who has not had a capital murder trial before. Jailhouse snitches. We still allow jailhouse snitches to testify. Every jail has a guy looking at more time who will cut a deal, and the cops know how to manipulate that guy. So he'll be in a cell with the accused. He'll hear a full confession. They pull him out. He shows up in trial 6 months later with a coat and tie on. He says, oh, yeah, he confessed to me. Here are the details of the crime that the cops gave him. And so he testifies. And these guys, and judges still allow that today. And there are ways to deal with jailhouse snitches. The best way is just don't let them testify if they're doing it because of they want less time.
How do you feel about the death penalty?
I'm very much opposed to it because the way we do it is so grossly unfair.
For all the reasons you're citing.
All those reasons. Plus, if you look at who gets executed, you can commit one murder in the state of Missouri, go next door in Kansas, the same crime, and get different penalties.
Yeah.
You know, and it's heavily slanted toward minorities. It's a mess. And from a moral reason, I'm opposed to it. You know, if it's immoral and wrong to kill, who gives us the right to kill? So I've been opposed to the death penalty for a long time.
You know, you've been on the state legislative side of things. You were a lawmaker once in Mississippi, and obviously the country has gone through this whole tough-on-crime era where lawmakers don't want to appear as coming off as too easy on criminals. But you wonder, so why haven't we fixed these things, given the fact we know now we're putting innocent people to death across this country?
Well, the innocence is one issue, but what you're talking about is mass incarceration, because when you have laws like three strikes, out, all these tough laws we passed over the past 30 years, and tough politicians get reelected because, you know, they get tougher and tougher. Who can be the toughest guy? You wind up with prisons full of people who are guilty, who've committed some crimes, but don't deserve the long sentences. You know, we have 1 million young black men in prison right now who are convicted felons. And we're just warehousing them, this mass incarceration hysteria that we've had for the – and the good thing about it is from both sides of the aisle, we're starting to talk.
Yeah. Okay? You do see a change.
From the left, it's a matter of human rights and decency and what's fair. And so there's some of that in the middle or on the right. From the right, you've got just the sheer cost of it.
Yeah.
When you put a man in prison for 40 years because he has 3 drug convictions, okay, you got to feed him 3 times a day, and you have to provide some level of health care. It's not great, but you have to do something. Well, as our prison population is aging, it's becoming terribly expensive.
Yeah.
And so we have 2.5 million people in prison right now, or in jail behind bars. That's the highest incarceration rate of anywhere in the civilized
world.
Yeah.
John Grisham is here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. His appearance tonight with Candace Millard at Unity Temple on the Plaza is sold out, just so you know that information, 816-235-2888. Let's go to your new book, John, your 31st novel, and you're back working with the law here. You focused on a for-profit law school, a suicide, a conspiracy, and outsized student loans. I teach up here on campus, and I know what you're talking about. You got this idea from an article in The Atlantic. Tell us about it.
3 years ago, the fall of 2014, The Atlantic published an investigative piece by a guy named Paul Campos, and it was called The Law School Scam.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read it then. I saw it sometime later online, not sure how I stumbled across it. I was not familiar with for-profit law schools.
I was going to say, why would someone go to a for-profit? That's got bad news written all over it, doesn't it?
Why do we have anything for-profit in education?
Yeah, well, there you go.
I mean, education should be the province of state, local, and federal government. I don't know why you make a buck off kids to educate them.
Mm-hmm.
But they are proliferated and proliferating under the new administration that's lessening the rules that regulate these people because well, Trump University, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you've got several for-profit law schools still existing in the country. I think there are 6 or 7 of them, not sure exactly. One closed in August, and they charge huge tuitions. That's the profit. They provide a legal education that is not that good.
Mm-hmm.
They appeal to a lot of unqualified students who really shouldn't be in law school,
yeah.
who can borrow whatever it takes from the federal government, basically, and who are ill-prepared, who cannot find jobs, and who can't pass a bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the law school scam. And it's blowing up even as we speak. I almost got to the issue too late. And that's not to say that they're all bad. There's some success stories from these schools, I suppose. I didn't research all the schools. I didn't have time.
Right.
But I think last year their bar pass rate was about 50%, which, you know, is not great, but it's better than some state schools, I think. So, you know, there's some success stories of these schools, but just the idea of borrowing $75,000 a year for 3 years to get a law degree just strikes me. And these schools are being bought and sold. You know, how do you buy and sell a law school?
Yeah.
So that was the beginning. I really jumped into it with a lot of research and am still fascinated by the issue.
And the plot is?
Well, I can't give it away. I want people to go buy the book, okay?
Of course, tease us, John Grisham.
I was joking. It's three law students at a subpar law school in downtown Washington, D.C., who are in their final semester, and they can't find jobs, and they owe $200,000 to the federal government that they can't repay, and they are depressed and frustrated, and they feel as though they've been scammed. And one of their close friends is really goes over the cliff. And his suicide just takes all of their enthusiasm away from life.
Mm.
And they decide to drop out of law school and get some revenge against the system.
Mm.
And so they do.
Tell us the name of the law school. I love this.
It's a real place. Foggy Bottom, as we know, is a real place. It's where the State Department's located. That's where there's actually a law school in Foggy Bottom. It's George Washington. It's a very good law school. So I said it at the Foggy Bottom Law School.
Okay. Let's go to some phone calls for John Grisham, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Ron from Kansas City, Missouri. Ron, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Pleasure to be on the phone with you all this morning. Hey, I just have a quick question, aspiring writer who wonders, how have you adjusted over the years? This question, of course, for John. Over the years with your syntax and your semantics, knowing that people communicate maybe a little differently even than they did in the 80s with the shorthand, with the taking off of the text messaging and those type of things. Have you had to make any adjustments, other ways of communicating that you don't use anymore?
Thanks, Ron. I have not consciously made any adjustments. Don't plan to. You know, when we communicate now, we take a lot of shortcuts because we can. It's faster. But I really try to resist that when I'm writing. However, in the current book, there's a fair amount of texting and emailing that goes on, and I try to be realistic with that.
I hope that helps, Ron.
Oh, that helps a lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good luck, Ron.
Yeah. You know, I've read that you tend to talk your stories, your plot ideas to death with Renee, your wife. And do I have that right?
She would say to talk about it. Yeah, she would agree with that.
Does it help? It does, doesn't it? Talk it out ahead of time?
Oh, yeah. I have to pitch the idea to her before it's going to fly.
Mm-hmm.
She has to like it. And she gets tired of this because I do it so often. And she enjoys shooting one down if she doesn't like it. And that leads to some heated words. And when our kids were small, they would come running into the kitchen because of the, you know, the loud voices. And then they realized we were just arguing over a book.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a real fight. They thought they'd caught a real fight, you know. We're just arguing over the books again.
Hey, you've also said it's hard for you to write female characters, which I guess only makes sense. But
sure.
But,
I mean, can you think like a woman? I can't think.
Yeah. You live with one, so do I.
Yeah, but she doesn't think like me. It's Venus and Mars. It's really difficult to do that. I've tried it a few times. But when I've done it, it's hard to get too deep into the personality of the narrator when she is a female.
Let's go to Tom from Fairway. Tom, welcome to the show.
Tom, Steve, thank you. Mr. Grisham, just read Whisper and Camino Island, loved them. very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Wanted to pose something to you. The media tells us more about guns and ammo, like in the Las Vegas shooting, you know, how many guns were in the room, how much ammo was in the room, the angle, but it doesn't do its job about the injuries and loss of life and all the people that were the mothers, the fathers, the daughters, the friends, the cousins, and all the positive effects that could have happened but for the guns and the ammo. I don't know what can be done, but I wanted to pose the question to you because you obviously know so much about the violence, and you write about, you know, in The Whisper, the violence that happened there.
I'll
just pose it to you.
All the weapons, all the ammunition out there, John.
Well, I think we've lost our minds. When you can buy weapons like that, all you want, legally, and when you can actually carry weapons on your hip nowadays in most states, we need some serious gun reform. I believe in gun rights. I own guns, to hunt with or for protection. I'm not in favor of abolishing guns, but, let's be honest. Our politicians are so terrified of the NRA, we can't even ban assault weapons.
Yeah.
We tried 20 years ago for a year or two, and they repealed the ban because Congress folded again. That's the truth.
Yeah.
Most members of Congress are terrified of the NRA. And as long as we have that type of fear, we're going to have all these goofy, stupid gun laws that are going to lead to more and more mass killings.
Yeah.
They're not going to stop.
Yeah, we just talked a minute ago about how hard it is for you to write about female characters, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but you've also said writing about sex, forget it. It just doesn't work.
We go from guns to sex.
There you go. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, my wife has always said men cannot write sex, okay? And mm-hmm. I've heard that from a lot of people. Men just – Harold Robbins is pretty good at it, though, and he sold a bunch of books. I just don't have my last book was Camino Island, and there was a sex scene. There was time for the male protagonist and the female protagonist to finally get together in a romantic situation and crawl in the sack and have some fun, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm there, and I've got that scene in front of me, and I thought, I'm not going to start describing body parts and things like that. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do with this, okay? I can't do it. I can't write it, okay? So, I failed again. So they woke up the next morning, okay?
Fast forward.
That's all I could do.
816-235-2888. John Grisham's in the studio. Sam from Kansas City, Missouri. Sam, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Sam.
So I was wondering, so since John started as a lawyer, I'm wondering which part of that career best served his career now, whether it's writing legal briefs or arguing closing arguments. And what is the most like being a writer that an attorney can get?
Well, first,
that's a good question.
Not even close. It's the ability to know the law. When I start reading a book about the law or about a trial or about, you know, some piece of litigation or some law firm.
You get frustrated. What you read.
I can tell you within 10 pages if the writer is a lawyer.
Yeah, and he or she knows what they're talking about.
Knows what they're talking about. And it's I read Scott Turow, David Baldacci. I read the other guys. I know them, and I enjoy their books. But they bring a sense of authenticity to the subject matter. It's just, mm-hmm. I wouldn't dare try to write about architecture or medicine or, something like engineering. I wouldn't know where to start.
Yeah.
But a lot of writers try to sort of fake it, and I think they probably get by with it because most people are not lawyers.
Yeah.
But for lawyers, it's very frustrating to read a book and you say, wait a minute, that couldn't happen.
Yeah.
There's no way that happens that way. So that's what the legal background brings to the writing.
Sam, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, not long ago, John, you said this, I'm a famous writer in a country where no one reads. And I'm thinking, ouch. But you obviously hit on something there. How concerned are you about the lack of reading in this country? And again, you're talking to a lifelong journalistic scribe here, so I think I know what you're talking about. But what do you make of it? How concerned are you about it?
I'm very concerned.
Yeah,
the publishing is very concerned because I think all trends are going the wrong direction because the typical American buys fewer books a year, reads fewer books a year. That's a trend that's been going down. And you worry about the kids these days and how they spend their free time. When we were reading, they're playing video games or Facebooking or whatever.
Yeah.
There's so many other things they can do to enjoy themselves and not read.
You've tried to address that through your Theodore Boone series. Theo, tell us about that.
Well, Theodore Boone is a kid series that I started 6 or 7 years ago. My daughter was teaching school. She is a school teacher, and she was teaching a bunch of fifth graders. And she asked me one night over dinner if I could write suspense for kids. She said, she pushes reading strongly in her classroom, and she said there are a lot of books for kids, obviously, but it's fantasy, it's historical fiction, it's all these different types of. She said, I can't find any real good suspense. Huh. Can you write suspense for kids? And it was a great question.
Yeah, no
kidding.
And I
thought, okay, I thought about it. So I created this character named Theodore Boone, who's a 13-year-old boy. Both of his parents are lawyers, and Theo thinks he's a lawyer because he knows so much about the law.
Right.
And he's always getting in trouble because he gives his friends free legal advice. And he's also a fun kid. He gets caught up in all these conflicts and dramas, and he's also into scouting. He loves the outdoors, and I've written 6 of them, and they're just a lot of fun to write.
Let me squeeze in a last question here real quick. Paul from Shawnee. Paul, go quick if you would.
Yes, I understand you had started a baseball field for Little League, and parents, I'm not sure they were allowed or not. I was just curious how that's going.
The baseball field, John. I got 30 seconds here.
Yeah, I built a baseball park close to our house 20 years ago because there were no baseball parks in our end of the county, and we have 500 kids each year on playing on 7 ball fields, and parents are still invited, but I'm thinking about banning all parents, but I haven't done that, haven't done so yet. Thank you.
John Grisham's new book, The Rooster Bar, he'll be talking with Candace Millard tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. The event's sold out. Maybe you can bribe somebody to get your way in. John, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks
My
so
pleasure.
Much.
Thanks
you
for
bet.
Having me.
On tomorrow's show, we'll talk about the new KCI airport ballot question and that voters will decide on Tuesday. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.